Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast where I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. My guest tonight is Joe Rosenstiel. Joe, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
It's always a pleasure. So tell the people a little bit about yourself, Joe.
I am a visual effects artist that does film, TV stuff, and not that fancy. Not that good either.
Oh, no.
Look it up on IMDb. But I do also podcasting things, which would probably be the thing that more people would know me from doing. Visual effects is a little impersonal. But I do the Defocus podcast on the Incomparable Network with my co-host Dan Sturm, who's been on this podcast before as well. Mm-hmm. And I also am an occasional panelist on other Incomparable properties.
Oh, I was on Defocused once, I believe, and never invited back.
Well, that's mainly because of a scheduling thing where we usually record at 9 o'clock at night and also talk about movies that I'm not sure you'd be interested in. Although recently, I through Dan being tired, I conned him into watching Star Trek movies again. But they were the not so beloved ones. And he has put his foot down on any further thing because I wanted to get to the not so beloved ones to get to the ones I like better. Joe, maybe I can use you to con him into Star Trek VI at some point.
Oh, Star Trek VI is a good one. I did see that you had done Star Trek III, not a good one. And I assume Star Trek V? I don't know if you did V yet.
Yes, V will be, it will probably be out by the time this episode's out. That is the very not good one. Three is, I think, maybe it's a little mediocre. Not necessarily bad, but like not fantastic.
Joe, you and I have had two brushes with Star Trek in the last couple of weeks that I want to talk about. I don't know if you want to talk about it, but I want to talk about it, so we're going to talk about it. You, I believe, are in an airport. And you saw somebody that is recognizable.
Yes, I saw George Takei. I was at the Los Angeles International Airport in the United Lounge, not because I have any sort of lounge status, but my boyfriend does. So we were up there. And sure enough, I see this guy walking from behind me. So I'm only seeing the back of him as he's walking away back towards his seat. And then he stops to take a photo with somebody. And I'm like, huh. He seems familiar, and then I realize it's George Takei, and then he sits down with his husband and starts reading a newspaper, and that's the extent of my interaction with that. It to say that I did not interact, merely observed.
And I feel like, well, I'll get to mine in a moment, but you live on the West Coast where all the famous people live. So I assume that you're running into people all the time. Like, you go to pick up milk and Brad Pitt is there. Is that right?
Sure. No. Almost never, really. And not usually the stars that you would think either. One time when I was getting my security badge, when I first started at Sony, I saw Don Johnson in real life. Much shorter than you think he is. But he was there in person. And then another time I saw whoever it was that plays Abby Carmichael and was in Rizzoli and Isles. I think she was Rizzoli.
Oh.
Yeah, she walked past me because she was in a designer furniture shop, and I was like, "Oh, wait, I know who you are." And that's it.
Well, my favorite. This is not a Star Trek thing, but it's just weird to see famous people not where you expect them to be, which is anywhere that you are. At least if you're me, like, I don't expect to see anybody. It's kind of like seeing like your grade school teacher in like the supermarket or something. You're like, you don't leave the school. You are always there. You're out of context. I don't understand what's happening. So when I was working for Comcast, I work for Comcast. They sent me to, for whatever reason, President Obama's inauguration. So I went, which was nice. And I went to this ball because Comcast sent me. It was very strange. And I walked in and I saw this woman walking towards me. And I thought, what are the chances that someone I know is at this inaugural ball? And she walked towards me and I was like, I know this woman. Who is this woman? And then I realized, oh, it's Jamie Lee Curtis. And I do not know her. so I should not talk to her. And I didn't. But that was a weird evening because I walked around and I saw Ben Affleck talking to Larry David. And I was like, this is very strange. And then I almost knocked over Jesse Jackson. That was not, his bodyguards were not amused. And then the weirdest thing was someone tapped me on the shoulder and said, will you take our picture? And so I turned around and I said, of course. And it was this woman. And standing next to her was Sting. Sting, very short as well. I didn't talk to any of them. But my Star Trek thing is I was in Western Massachusetts a couple weekends ago at a burger joint, local burger. It was delicious. I had a turkey burger. And I ordered my turkey burger. And I looked, I sat down and waited for my turkey burger to arrive. And I was chatting with my wife and my friend that we were visiting, who was in the midst of watching Deep Space Nine. So she had, before we got to the burger place, she said to me, I'm in the first season of Deep Space Nine. Tell me that Jadzia Dax and Julian Bashir don't end up together. And I said, well, how much do you know about season 7? And she said, I know nothing about it. And I said, okay, then I can tell you Jadzia Dax and Julian Bashir do not end up together. And she said,
it's not that merciful in a way.
No. And then we were sitting there, so I was thinking about I had just had a conversation about Dr. Bashir. And so I looked up and I thought, I think that is Alexander Siddig, who plays Dr. Bashir. But what are the chances that he would be in this random hot hamburger place in Western Massachusetts after I had just had a conversation about it? But sure enough, it was him. I did not talk to him either because I thought that would be weird. I looked at him a couple times and I listened for his voice to make, cause it could have been some other like skinny guy that looks like him, but it was definitely him. So that's my story. Didn't talk to him, but nobody seemed to notice who he was except for me.
I feel like we unfortunately got a lot of flack from people for not talking to these famous people. And, I am in agreement with you. I think our philosophies align on, you should never talk to anyone, that you see that's important. Just hunker down.
That's why I wanted to bring it up. Not only because we both had these brushes with Star Trek fame, but I wanted to, because I know you didn't talk to George K and I didn't talk to, but I feel like, what would I say to him? I feel like they're just there living their lives. They don't want to talk to me.
Yes. I've been informed that they do want to talk to us, but I'm not going to.
I don't think that's true.
Yeah. They just say that. It was definitely an interesting experience to witness him from afar, as I imagine it was for you.
It was. He was just there having a hamburger with somebody. I don't know who he was with. Why should I know? It doesn't matter. But I was tempted. And my wife was like, oh, you should go tell him that you like Deep Space Nine. And I was like, well, why would I? And I also, the other thing was I couldn't remember his name. So I would have to be like, I was afraid if I went up to talk to him that I would call him Julian. And that would just be mortifying. Because I know that's not his name.
Well, as long as you don't tell him that you didn't really like his character very much at first, and then you grew to like him over time.
Well, that was the other thing I thought, like, oh no, I'm just going to have like this complete meltdown and just tell him, I really enjoyed Deep Space Nine. I didn't really like Dr. Bashir the couple first seasons, but then you grew on me, don't worry. And I really like Miles O'Brien and his relationship. And then I'd be like, he doesn't want to hear any of this, and he just wants to eat his hamburger. So I don't need to. I was afraid I would overshare Joe. That's what I was afraid of.
Yeah. Because
he doesn't care. Although maybe he does. I don't know. I did also, here's my other, and then we can talk about the episode that we're supposed to talk about. I went to see the premiere of the Deep Space Nine documentary a couple of months ago, or several months ago, in New York City, because someone who listens to Random Trek invited me to go with him. And so I went, because that was nice. And I went to use the bathroom, and then I was coming back, and I looked, and someone was walking in front of me, and I thought to myself, is that Ethan Phillips of Neelix fame? I was like, well, you know, it's a Deep Space Nine documentary, but he's in the Star Trek family, so perhaps it would make sense. But it seemed weird. And then I sat down, and sure enough, he was there because he stood up and did some strange stand-up comedy. Which, you know, it was fine, but it was just weird. But that was my other brush. I didn't talk to him either because I couldn't even say Neelix grew on me because he didn't. So,
That's a good thing you didn't get the opportunity to overshare with Ethan Phillips.
I didn't want to, but I enjoy his other work is what I would tell him if I had to talk to him, but I wouldn't, so it's fine.
I liked your appearance in Bad Santa. that one time you were a hologram, anyway.
I did enjoy that. That was good. His stand-up was not bad, but it was like the only reason he's able to do this is because he was Neelix, and this is a Star Trek documentary, so he's doing stand-up.
Was it Star Trek stand-up, or was it just general stand-up?
He did a little pandering with Star Trek stand-up, but then he just had... It's clear like he's working on a stand-up routine, which is difficult, so I don't want... And I applaud him for giving it a go, but he still needs to work on his routine.
Well, hopefully that feedback will find its way to him gently.
I'm sure someone will forward this to him, or maybe he's a random Trek listener, and a single tear is rolling down his cheek. Probably not.
That would be a sad hobby for him.
It would be. He should be living his life doing stage acting, is what I assume he does. Live your best life, Neelix. That's what I say. But anyway, let's talk about Deep Space Nine, shall we? The episode that we watched for this episode of Random Trek was Rocks and Shoals, which is an episode in season 6, episode 2. In my mind, I confuse this with the episode where they meet... what's his face? The other Vorta, Weyoun, for the first time. But that is not this episode.
No, it does have some similarities and specifically mentions that episode.
Yes.
But it is not that episode. Also, it reminds me of The Ship, which is, turns out, season 5, episode 2. So exactly one season ago, if that were some sort of a calendar. But it's also apparently shot in the same location. So that's probably why it reminds me of it. It's a rock quarry in Sun Valley.
So now we've already established that you are in the industry. You're a big time Hollywood hotshot.
Yes.
and I was struck by the special effects in this episode, specifically the shot where the ship is falling into the atmosphere, and then later when they frame they have swam up the shoal, I guess, and we see in the distance the ship sinking, and I thought they looked really good. Now, am I wrong?
No, especially for the time period that this was done in, it's obvious that it is a composite of various things, but it is done well for the era. There are some missing pieces in terms of how they get from that dense nebula to the planet. There's no visually connecting piece that carries you from one to the other. The little particles that are coming off of the ship as it's falling, with its little scorch marks still flickering and embers going, it's pretty neat, and it adds to the suspense of the teaser, which works. Now, there's not much other ship special effects work that's in here. You see it sinking, mm-hmm. And you see the coastline, which is not really there because again they're in a rock quarry, but all that stuff's composited, and it looks good for the time period. And it certainly is more convincing than in TNG, where it'd be like, look at that stuff that's off camera. Don't look at it. It's fine.
Don't look at it too hard. We'll quickly show you and then look away. And I thought it was clever also, probably to save budget, the idea that we did not see the connective, like, hurtling through the nebula and landing on or crash landing on the planet. But the way they get around that in the story is that they're on a Dominion ship, obviously, and they all have those little, I don't know what they call them, the little viewfinder goggle things, like the Google Glass Jem'Hadar edition. Mm-hmm. And they weren't working, and because they got beaten up by another Jem'Hadar ship, and then they're in this nebula, so they don't really see what's going on. And then Garak fixes his by tapping it, and it works, and he sees and he's like, oh no, hold on. Although my quibble with that is he probably should have told people what was happening instead of just saying hold on.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's effective for the teaser of this. Maybe he said it after they cut out to the ship crashing, because they also seem to have actual time. They were very high up still at that point.
That's true. They had a lot of time. So hopefully he didn't just say, hold on. And then everyone was like, why? And, hold on. No, keep holding on. Garak, we need more context.
Yeah. The one thing that doesn't really work for me in this opening is when you see Jadzia fall over backwards over the railing, mm-hmm. and the railing instantly collapses. as if it were just gently held together by almost nothing.
What? And then she's grievously injured, we're led to believe. I don't know why I said led to believe. She is, in fact, within the story, injured. And then they crash, and that's the opener.
I do like the moment with Chief O'Brien and Nog, where O'Brien saying "damn" nonstop, and then Nog says it one time, and O'Brien's like, "Watch your mouth."
That's right. He's still an ensign. He can't use that kind of salty language. O'Brien is wizened, and he can say whatever he wants. And there's some good Nog stuff in this episode. But one of my questions about Nog is, so then after the teaser, we are shown, I think the first thing we see is Nog swimming up to the coastline there, and Garak helps him out. But then they immediately show everybody else like floating with a bunch of cargo. And that made me think, is Nog just a really bad swimmer? Like, shouldn't he? It feels like he had more time than it took him to like get up there. But I don't know.
Maybe he's just tired.
It's they're all
looks
tired.
Like they looks like they swam a long way, but he might not be, like you said, he might not be a super experienced swimmer. I don't know how much swimming there is on Ferenginar, and also he was mostly raised on a space station where there's no swimming.
That is true, unless maybe in the holosuite he swims a lot, yeah. But apparently not. And this is, I think, most infamous part of this episode is, you know, they've crash landed, things are not looking great, Jadzia's injured, and they're up there, and Miles O'Brien is like, oh great, and Sisko's like, well, what's wrong? And Miles is like, oh, I ripped my pants.
Yeah, I remember when we did, there was a Star Trek episode draft, and Aline's husband, Justin, had picked this. Well, not picked this. I picked this? Who picked this?
Was somebody it me? Picked this.
I don't remember. Somebody picked this episode, but he cited the torn pants specifically as something that appealed to him, a line that stuck out. And it's kind of funny because, you know, all this other stuff, and he has a very minor concern in light of it.
Well, I feel like it's relatable because we've all been in those situations where like everything is going wrong. You're overwhelmed by the amount of stuff that's going wrong. And then some minor thing happens and you're like, ugh, even this thing. Like, you know, you found out your taxes are overdue, your car is broken, and then you take out a pencil to write a note down and it breaks and you're like, ugh. And then you crack up laughing because nothing is going your way. And that's the way Miles O'Brien feels right now. Luckily, Garrick's there, and he's like, oh, you ripped it on the seams, so I can fix this easily. But my sewing kit is on the ship that sank into the water, so I can't help you.
I don't know, as part of this, if we need to frame like where this is at in the season 6 station, not station arc of things, because it is just kind of throwing you in cold. Like, if you had just turned this on for the first time since season 5 or something, you'd be a little confused about what was happening with the ship falling out of orbit, being chased by Jem'Hadar stuff, and they're all on board a Jem'Hadar fighter.
Yes, and then you're even more confused when you're like, well, I guess maybe they stole a Jem'Hadar fighter. But then they go back to Deep Space Nine, and they're like, Cardassians everywhere, and you're like, what the heck is going on? Things are not going well for the Federation in the Dominion War at this point in Deep Space Nine. They have lost Deep Space Nine. They I forget how they end up on this Jem'Hadar ship, but I think they stole it so that they could try to break in and blow something up. Is that right? Am I misremembering things?
This is the ship from the episode, the ship that they recovered.
Yes.
And it was at the starbase, which is just regular one, which is just that space dock model turned upside down. And they are reassigned from the Defiant to that Jem'Hadar ship to go on this special mission to deliver bombs to a Ketracel White facility where they're supposed to beam down in empty containers. And they do that in the previous episode, but they don't get out of the shield in time and are damaged a little by the experience. And then it leaves with like, oh no, it's going to take forever to do the stuff to get us back. And then you get the supplemental log that leads you into the beginning of this episode. But it's not entirely clear maybe if you just like jump in from the start of this, because it's just like, huh, that's not really like the Defiant or a Runabout or anything.
Yeah, why are they on Deep Space Nine? And who are these Cardassians? Yes, and so they crash land on this planet that is apparently empty of all life, except, oh no, also crash landed on this planet separately and previously is a Vorta and his Jem'Hadar who are hanging out. The Vorta, much like Dax, has been grievously injured. Sadly for the Vorta, they do not bring doctors with them. So he just has a bunch of surly Jem'Hadar soldiers who are not big fans of his to help him. And so he is not happy. And neither are they.
I wonder, like, what is first aid like on a Dominion ship? Is there like a Vorta doctor or like, what do they do?
I don't know. I feel like the founders are not overly concerned with the welfare of either the Vorta or the Jem'Hadar. And they can just make more. So it's like, who we don't really care about. Like this, what's his name? Keevan? Is that his name?
Yeah,
the Vorta?
Keevan.
Like they'll just make another Keevan if he doesn't come back in the right time. So they don't really care about him, I don't think. So I don't think.
Yeah, but if he bumps his head or something and they'd be like, nope. Time to get rid of this clone. Make another Keevan.
Kill that Keevan. That's why the Vorta are so careful. They want to avoid any injuries or bruises because that's a death sentence for them. And that's what makes the... I think that as I was watching this episode, I thought to myself, Star Trek aliens are... not super alien generally, because they're mostly just people with funny things on their forehead. The Jem'Hadar and the founders and the Vorta, I feel like, are Star Trek's at this point in time, like their best, like alien, most alien race of aliens, because they don't really act the way that other people on Star Trek think they should. Does that make sense?
Yes, I completely agree with you. They have a different philosophy that they see things with, and each of them distinctly has their own different philosophy for how they see things.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a natural order to stuff, and it justifies their actions. And so even when Sisko is trying to reason with Mataclan or with Keevan in this episode,
mm-hmm.
He's trying to do it from his human point of view and trying to relate to them on that level, whereas that's not what motivates Rumataklan, and it's not what motivates Keevan. That they have completely different worldviews from Sisko, so he's not able to easily convince them to do anything.
Right, and he's like, oh, this is... I almost had him with like my 5 second exaltation for him to turn on his Vorta. And I was like, I don't know if he really almost had him, Sisko, but... good try.
It seemed like Rumataklan was not like 100% behind Keevan.
Well, that's true. Rumataklan was not a big fan of Keevan because Keevan is pretty much a jerk. I think all Vorta are jerks, though. That's kind of their thing. And specifically, the first and the second of the Jem'Hadar troop have died, but he won't make Rumataklan, who is the third, the first, because... of whatever Vorta reasons he has, because he's a jerk, really.
There was that dialogue between Rumataklan and I don't remember the other
seventh, maybe.
Yeah, and it's like you are going to be the first now, and it's like, well, I'm not going to be the first because I question the Vorta's orders, and so he's never going to make me the first as long as he's alive. And it doesn't seem to really impact anything or mean anything other than there's like a number gap that seems to make everybody uncomfortable.
But he's
still
Joe.
Like the most senior, most highest, lowest number. I don't know. He's the top dog, even at number three.
That is true because the other two are dead. So there's nobody else, but then some other dude gets busted down to like six or something. So I don't know what's happening over there, but so this is the setup. Is they're on this planet, they don't know that each other are there, but the Jem'Hadar, I think, oh yes, Garak and Nog are off looking for something, I don't know what, maybe they're just scouting the area, and they come across the Jem'Hadar who uncloak themselves and take them back to the Vorta, and the Vorta's like, you know, tell me your who's in your party and all this stuff. And Nog is like, I will give you my name, rank, and serial number. And Garrick tries to lie as well as he can, and which I enjoyed the scene where Garrick spins this very convincing tale. And then the voter's like, well, why were you wearing this communicator then if you're on our side? And Garrick says, I was hoping you wouldn't ask about that. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, I really love that Garrick is not simple about these things. Like he has a whole plan ready to go into action at any moment. And the Kievan, though, while being incapacitated and also evil and a jerk, is still like sharp enough to see through what Garrick is trying to spin here.
Yes, and he gives him enough rope to spin out this elaborate tale when he could have just said, I know you're lying, just save everyone the effort. But he lets Garrick tell his whole tale about his very elaborate tale about how he's got there. And Kievan's like, no, it's not true. And then Kievan is like, well, tell me this. Do you have a doctor in your party? And Garrick is like, yes, we do. Nog, not so happy about that. But Garrick wants to make sure they survive because he knows that they're not dealing with Starfleet officers. Like if he tells them no, it's just us, they'll just kill them because there's no need. Like the Jem'Hadar don't keep prisoners for no reason, which is something that I don't think Nog realizes. But
no, Nog is fresh out of Starfleet Academy. It's strange though that Nog doesn't have more street smarts or something, like in terms of like Ferengi duplicity or in terms of hedging or anything. He's over the years at Starfleet Academy, he's apparently become very Starfleetified in terms of his naivete that's come into play.
Yes, he does not have any guile at whatsoever. And maybe that's part of him kind of rejecting his Ferengi-ness and trying to embrace the Federation and the morals that the Federation expounds as opposed to his native culture. He's gone completely Federation, and he will not lie, and he won't do any of that stuff. But in this case, probably should have told a little lie, or at least tried to got out of that situation alive, which he did, thanks to Garrick, because basically the Kievan wants the Dr. Bashir, who I found out enjoys a hamburger, to come and fix him up, basically. And so he sends off the third. I want to call him Tenochtitlan, but that is not right.
Ramataclan.
There you go. To tell Benjamin Sisko, hey, we'll trade our prisoners for you and your doctor. And Sisko says, why would I do that? And he says, you shouldn't, but this is the deal we've got. And he basically, the Jem'Hadar promises that they will leave alive if they come. And so he does. And everybody, he fixes I'm saying this like I didn't enjoy this episode. This is a really good episode, but it's all about the interactions between the two groups and between Sisko and the Jem'Hadar and figuring out, you know, I can't really reason with him, even though I think on an intellectual level, Ramataclan, I cannot say his name, agrees with Sisko, but he cannot do what Sisko wants him to do.
Yeah, he can definitely, well, and it's shown later on when they're in the trap that he can figure all this stuff out. He's not just blindly following this stuff, but he
knows what's going on.
He passionately believes in his principles and his philosophy about what his life is for and why he exists. And so he does all this stuff, even though he knows that all the other people might think that it's invalid or silly or not worth it. But he has that duality of getting it, but still doing it, even though he understands that it would mean his death or something else, and it doesn't seem entirely reasonable.
Yes, and so the Kievan is running out of Ketracel White. So he's like, after the doctor fixes him up, he says, listen, I'm going to run out of Ketracel White. There are a bunch of Jem'Hadar, and you don't like them when they have Ketracel White. They're worse when they don't have Ketracel White. So I'm going to tell them to attack your base tomorrow morning. But I'm going to tell you what their plan is going to be so that you can kill them all. And then you can come back and get me and my communicating device that you don't have, and you take me off this planet and we all win. And Sisko's like, well, that doesn't seem very nice. And Kivan, and this is a very Vorta thing, he's like, I'm going to tell them to kill you no matter what. So if you don't do it, you're going to die. So you might as well just kill them. Which I thought was very clever. I mean, not good, but clever.
Yeah, I agree. And I also, at first you might be watching this episode and you're like, oh no, it's not, you know, Jeffrey Combs' Wayoon. You know, you might be thinking, I would love to have Wayoon in here instead of Kevin. But then as you get into this part of the episode, you're just like, oh, I like that he's actually very sort of different in a different jerky way, a very self-serving way than Jeffrey Combs' Wayoon is. He's not exactly the same Vorta as Wayoon.
But they're cut from the same cloth, but they're different aspects of the same kind of Vorta nature, I feel like.
Yes.
Because he's looking out for himself. And he basically is like, these Jem'Hadar are going to kill me. So why don't you kill them first, and then we can all live happily ever after. And this is, you know, I feel like this is a kind of story that up until this point only Deep Space Nine could tell, because this is the Federation people are like, well, we can't just slaughter these Jem'Hadar. That's not our way, and that seems wrong. And Sisko says, basically, listen, I wasn't putting this up for a vote. Like, this is my decision, and the choice is between us living or them living, and there's no choice. We are going to do this, which is what he says. But then he tells Dax, actually, I hope that I can get us out of this without killing them all. Spoiler alert, he cannot. But that's what the whole episode is leading up to, this very kind of climactic scene where the Jem'Hadar are coming, and Benjamin Sisko's like, hey, I want to talk to you before we kill each other. And he's like, okay. And so they talk, the Jem'Hadar and Captain Sisko. And Sisko's like, you know, we're going to kill you all. And Kivan told us your whole plan. And he's like, well, I kind of figured that out because this is a really bad plan. So, and Captain Sisko's like, well, if you know, he doesn't deserve your loyalty. Is basically, and this is like a very human thing, right? Like, Kivan did not earn your loyalty. He doesn't deserve for your people to die for him. And this is when he says, like, he doesn't have to earn my loyalty. He had it when I was born. I am made to do this, and I will do this.
It really sets them apart from Klingons. Because I think there's often a situation where people might be like, oh, there's like some weird honor that's going on here. And it's like, no, it's not honor, like between warriors, or honor with him and his men. It's a duty, it's subservience to a cause that is beyond them. So it's very different from Klingons in that regard.
Yeah, it's clear that they don't think that Kivan is honorable or worth their, like, if they could choose, they would not choose to be loyal to Kivan, because he does not deserve it, and he's been bad to them, and he's trying to get them all killed, and spoiler alert, he does, in fact. His plan works. They all die, except for him. But yeah, they have to. He has to do this. And then, yes, sadly, all the Jem'Hadar die. He is fine. Kivan comes along with his suitcase and his communication device, I think, and they get off the planet eventually, although they don't show us that. But I am rushing to it, because we have not talked about there's a B-plot that we have not talked about at all, which is also, I feel like, similar in that we see Kira back on the station, and it has been taken over by the Cardassians and the Jem'Hadar, and she's kind of doing her job and working for the Cardassians. Well, she's still working for the Bajoran government, but as a liaison to the Dominion. And there's a Kai, or a Vedic, I don't remember what her rank was.
Vedic Yasim? Vedic, I believe is her name.
Yes, who is basically like, listen, Kira, we can't let the prophets tell us that we must act against evil, and you're here collaborating and helping them. And Kira's like, and there was a very effective little scene of like Kira's morning, like she wakes up, she smiles to her mirror, she goes through, walks through the promenade, some Cardassian gives her a cup of coffee, she seems like she's having a great day. And then she has to deal with this Vedic, who basically is like, you're betraying your people by not fighting against this occupying force. And Kira, and it's interesting because Kira, right, is a freedom fighter and she's killed Cardassians and all kinds of stuff. And she's like, well, you don't really understand. This is like not an occupying force per se. They're just here. They're going to send some facilitators. They're not warriors. Is really fine. and you can tell that she doesn't really buy what she's saying, but she's trying to rationalize her role because she has been ordered by Sisko to basically stay here and be the inside person. Well,
not even the inside person, but to be neutral, to make sure that nothing happens to Bajor.
Oh, right. That's right. He doesn't want Bajor to be overrun by the Dominion. They want to be stayed out of the war. Yes. And so it's interesting. It's like she has this tension, like she has to be true to Bajor and try to protect it and not compromise, although she has kind of compromised a little bit in this episode until she talks to the Vedic, and the Vedic's like, hey, reassess your life. And Kira's like, you'll be fine. Everything's fine. I think you get the sense that at the end of their conversation, Kira is pretty sure she has at least stopped the Vedic from wanting to do her protest. But it turns out she did not. And the Vedic in what I think is a very effective scene and may require some kind of content warning or trigger warning or something. The Vedic hangs herself on the promenade. There's no other way to say it.
She commits suicide.
Yeah.
Right there.
And it is, I mean, I've seen this episode before, so I knew it was going to happen, but it was still shocking. And every time I see it, it is shocking. And that's the whole point of it. And very effective. And so this is when Kira realizes, I should probably stop being complicit in this and maybe start working against the Dominion. And she does.
And what's interesting with this is, like you said, how it's shot. Kira is there ready to use force, use the station, use the Bajoran security guards to stop a protest from occurring in front of the temple. And she's trying to ensure peace by suppressing the Bajorans.
Right. Because they're afraid that the Dominion will take this protest as an excuse to put on draconian measures and keep everyone confined to their rooms or something like that.
Yeah, they say that they're worried about there being a crackdown. Mm-hmm. And when Jake shows up and he's like, this is totally still on. This is happening. I got a message from Vedic Yasim to be here because he is also very bad at guile with his very blunt questions and very blunt answers. But then you see Vedic Yasim say evil must be opposed, and she's got the rope around her neck and jumps off in slow motion in what I think is a very effective shot. And we get the reaction shot of Kira in shock and surprise and reaching out towards Vedic Yasim. There's nothing that she could do, but she reaches out to try to get to Vedic Yasim or reach to her, and you just see her feet dangle there. It's shot really well by the director for this episode, Michael Vajar. I think it's Vajar, but he's done a few episodes of DS9, and Ron Moore said that he loved the way that he shot the episodes that he wrote, and he ended up, I think, using Michael Vajar for a lot of Battlestar Galactica stuff afterwards. It really gives weight and gravity. That's probably the wrong choice of words for this. It gives depth to what you're seeing here, which is, I hate to say it, it's not something you usually see in Star Trek. You don't usually see this sort of peaceful act of defiance of sacrifice for this cause, this protest to occur. It's very unusual. It's something that has happened in the real world, but it is not something that you usually see depicted on Star Trek. And it usually doesn't have a lasting impact on the characters of the show. But by the way that they compose Kira's mornings, which might seem dull when you're watching the episode, it helps contrast with what Kira thinks about after this has occurred. And I also like the way that they go back and they revisit her waking up in the morning, and they revisit her riding up in the turbo lift, and revisit her getting that cup of coffee or Ractagino or whatever it is, and how she just realizes she can't do it. She can't be a part of this without resisting. Mm-hmm. That she's the collaborator that she would have been opposed to when she was a resistance fighter.
I think that, and this is, I mean, I like Star Trek a lot. I don't know if people have picked up on this or not. But Deep Space Nine, when it works, which is more often than not, it really works. And it is, you know, once they figured out this whole Dominion War thing, it gets really interesting because, you know, the Starfleet that we know and love has been, their mission is to seek out and explore and, you know, meet new life forms, not, you know, blow them up. So there's always this tension, which is in this episode, right? Like Sisko, the logical choice is they are our enemies. We know their plan. We should ambush them and kill them and be fine with it and get the important military intelligence that this Vorta can give us. But that's not like, you know, that is not what Sisko wants to do because it just doesn't feel right. Like it's not what Starfleet does. You have to at least give them a chance to, you know, recant or, you know, solve it peaceably. And so that tension is very interesting. And that's what I think makes Deep Space Nine, unlike any other Star Trek series, and certainly stand out from the its contemporary Star Trek series, which would be Voyager, and a little bit of TNG, I suppose. Like they didn't do that at all. So it was interesting. That's what made it so interesting. That's why I like it so much.
Yeah. And unfortunately, this is the best appearance of Keevan because his next and only other appearance is in The Magnificent Ferengi, which I was reminded of a second ago. And I was just like, oh, no, that one.
Oh, no, everything's ruined. Is that the one where I forget what happens in The Magnificent Ferengi?
They accidentally kill Keevan and then they have to weaken at Bernie's to him mm-hmm. with a special servo suit that actuates him down a hallway so that they can rescue Quark and Rom's mother, and they were with Brunt. So the other Vorta in the episode is played by Iggy Pop.
Yes, of course. This is a better Keevan episode, so stick with this one. Not every Deep Space Nine episode is good, people. All right,
no,
but when it's good, like I said, when it's good is really good. But anyway, but much like this podcast, when you are on, Joe, because you always make a fine guest.
Oh, well, thank you. You are always a fine host of this podcast because you are the host of this podcast. But I could say other nice things.
Well, I'll take any compliment I can get. So thank you.